Okay, welcome to today's Sutta class. And for those of you who haven't picked up one of the sheets, because you have your own book and you're looking after the environment by purchasing your own book, which is very cheap, and it means that we don't have to keep printing things out on a photocopier. It's number 74 today, the Diganaka Sutta. And the reason that's been chosen, because apparently it's in the list of suttas which I haven't taught at this class. And one of the reasons I haven't taught this sutta before, it's a very short teaching. But I should be able to flesh it out to make it last the whole hour, especially hopefully with some of your questions. But it is a very important sutta, especially for any of you who have been on pilgrimage to India. And you've gone to the Vulture's Peak, and just as you go up to the top, just on the right-hand side of the path as you go up, there is the Boar's Cave. And it's wonderful to be able to see that little cave, to sit in it, and to know that this is where that sutta happened. So you can even visualize this, quite a small cave, quite low, and not that deep. And this was the place where one of the great disciples of the Buddha, Sariputta, became an arahat, became fully enlightened. So it's an important sutta just for that. It's a place where the Buddha became enlightened. Does it sound okay, or is it too loud? Okay, he's got in there to do something. Is that okay? Hi, okay, very good. It's the excitement of teaching an amazing sutta, that's why. So here we go.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
So this is a Diganaka Sutta, and literally means long nails, like nails on your fingers. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha, in the Boar's Cave on the mountain Vulture Peak. And when I say that, I can visualize it now. Then the wanderer, Diganaka, went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. The wanderers in the time of the Buddha were individuals who had left the home, and instead of being part of a particular group or belonging to one teacher, they would wander from place to place, and whatever holy person there was, they would go and discuss, maybe learn something from them, and then stay by themselves. So there were people who were wandering from place to place, which is why they were called the wanderers, and there were many of them. And those, if you like, loosely affiliated holy people, or aspiring to be holy people, were very common in India at that time. And there were both men and women as well. There were female wanderers as well. Then the wanderer Diganaka went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When his courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side and said to the Blessed One, "Master Gotama, my doctrine and view is this. Nothing is acceptable to me." Now many of those wanderers, sometimes they thought of themselves as being teachers in their own right. And they went around propounding their own sort of teaching, or at least saying something to be able to argue with others. Now most of this was just, you know, being able to argue, like being debaters. So Master Gotama, my doctrine and view is this, nothing is acceptable to me. And to see sort of the humour of the Buddha. This view of yours, Agiwesana, which is just a nice compliment to call him Agiwesana. This view of yours, nothing is acceptable to me. Is not at least that view acceptable to you? So it's like a Zen monk's expression. If this view of mine were acceptable to me, Master Gotama, it too would be the same. It too would be the same. In other words, just trying to get out of that catch. He said, nothing's acceptable to me. So even the view, nothing's acceptable to me, cannot be acceptable to him. Which means everything is acceptable to him. He's in a sort of a logical bind there. Well, Agiwesana, there are plenty in the world who say, it too would be the same. It too would be the same. Yet they do not abandon that view, and they take up still some other view. There are few in the world who say, it too would be the same, it too would be the same, and who abandon that view and do not take up some other view. In other words, that particular view just becomes their doctrine and their dogma. And it means that, you know, they're not really renouncing anything at all. They're just making a stand on a metaphysical statement, which basically doesn't have much meaning. And so the Buddha carries on. Agiwesana, there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. Everything is acceptable to me. It's all okay. There are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. Nothing is acceptable to me. And there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. Something is acceptable to me, and something is not acceptable to me. Among these, the view of those recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine and view, everything is acceptable to me. I should actually mention the word acceptable is also quite well translated as pleasing. It's pleasing to me. So everything is pleasing to me. Is close to lust, close to bondage, close to delighting, close to holding, close to clinging. The view of those recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine and view, nothing is acceptable to me, is close to non-lust, non-bondage, close to non-delighting, close to non-holding, close to non-clinging. It didn't say it is non-clinging, it's just close to it. When this was said, the wanderer Diganaka remarked, in other words, he interrupted the Buddha. Master Gotama commends my point of view. Master Gotama recommends my point of view. So in other words, you know, he was saying earlier, I don't know if you noticed this, that nothing is acceptable to him. But that saying of the Buddha, what he did so far, was very acceptable to him. So he was very pleased. But the Buddha continues, nevertheless. Agiwesana, as to those recluses and Brahmins who hold a doctrine and view, something is acceptable to me, something is not acceptable to me, the last of the three. The view of theirs as to what is acceptable is close to lust, close to bondage, close to delighting, close to holding, close to clinging, while the view of theirs as what is not pleasing is not is close to non-lust, close to non-bondage, close to non-delighting, close to non-holding, close to non-clinging. Now straight away, I point out that even the wanderers realize that the goal of that path would be to achieve something which was without lust, without desire. I'm not talking about the lust of sexual lust, I'm talking about all sort of craving for sensory pleasures. But the goal is to have non-bondage, to have a sense of freedom, however that freedom was expressed, depended upon the person's understanding and wisdom, and close to non-delighting, to non-holding, to non-clinging. Those were the goals of the holy life, not just for the Buddhists, but also for the wanderers. So the Buddha was talking in a language which everybody could understand, and it showed that this was a goal of people in those days, to have a state of free from craving, free from desire, non-bondage, non-delighting, non-holding, non-clinging. And the Buddha was saying that the ones which, when you are pleased with things, even when pleased with views, that is going to get very close to that desire, to bonding, especially bonding to this, that and the other. And when you say that some things are not pleasing to me, still that's not total freedom from desire, freedom from bondage, but it's getting closer to it. But it's quite clear that this wanderer, that particular view is just a rhetorical position, just a way of being able to win any argument with other people. So it wasn't really coming from the heart, it was obviously just coming from his head. Now, Agiwesana, a wise man among those lecturers and Brahmins who holds the doctrine and view, everything is acceptable to me and everything is pleasing to me, considers thus, if I obstinately adhere to my view, everything is pleasing to me, and declare only this is true, everything else is wrong, then I may clash with the two others, with the recluse and Brahmin who holds the doctrine of view, nothing is acceptable to me, and with those who hold the doctrine of view, something is pleasing and something is not pleasing to me. I may clash with these two. And when there is a clash, there are disputes. And when there are disputes, there are quarrels. When there are quarrels, there is vexation. For seeing him for himself, clashes, disputes, quarrels, and vexation, they abandon that view and do not take up some other view. This is how there comes to be the abandoning of these views. This is how there comes to be the relinquishing of these views. And the other two possibilities. A wise person amongst those recluses and Brahmins who holds a doctrine of view, nothing is pleasing to me, considers thus. If I obstinately adhere to my view, nothing is pleasing to me, and declare only this is true, everything else is wrong, then I may clash with the two others, with the recluse of Brahmins who holds a doctrine of view, everything is pleasing, and with those who say something is pleasing, something is not pleasing. I may clash with these two, and when there's a clash, there are disputes. When there are disputes, there are quarrels. When there are quarrels, there is vexation. For seeing for himself clashes, disputes, quarrels, and vexation, they abandon that view and do not take up some other view. The abandoning of these, this is how there comes to be the abandoning of these views. This is how there comes to be the relinquishing of these views. And thirdly, a wise person amongst those recluses and Brahmins who holds a doctrine in view, the last of the three, some things are pleasing, other things are not pleasing to me, considers us, if I obstinately adhere to my view, and I'm pointing that out now, if I obstinately adhere to my view, some things are pleasing to me, some things are not pleasing to me, and they declare only this is true, everything else is wrong, then I might clash with the other two others. With the recluse and Brahmin who holds the doctrine and view, everything is pleasing to me, and with those who hold the doctrine and view, nothing is pleasing to me. I may clash with these two others. And when there is a clash, there are disputes. When there are disputes, there are quarrels. When there are quarrels, there is vexation. For seeing for himself, clashes, disputes, quarrels, and vexation, they abandon that view. I do not take up some other view. This is how there comes to be the abandoning of these views. This is how there comes to be the relinquishing of these views. Now I'll pause there because here we have an interesting part of Buddhism. Here we have the idea of views, especially three types of views, and it can only be one of those three really, unless you see something a little bit deeper. You say, well, if you take one of these, you're going to argue with other people, so it's better just to not obstinately sort of accept these views and propound these views and say that all this is wrong, or sorry, all this is right, all other things are wrong. And so the wise person here is supposed to be abandoning disputes, quarrels, which lead to clashes and vexation. Now, sometimes that can be very easily misinterpreted. Is it the case that the Buddhism has no views whatsoever? Because if you have a view, then there'll be someone who has an opposite view to you, which means it will lead to clashes and vexation. So is the goal of Buddhism to have no view whatsoever at all? And in other suttas, there were a class of people who tried to actually hold no views at all. And they were called in Buddhism the eel wrigglers. And it goes something like this. They say, if it was true, I would say so, but I don't, and I don't say otherwise. In other words, they do whatever they can to actually to have no view whatsoever. And as you see in the beginning here, even say, I have no view. You say, even that is a view. And so to try and sort of wriggle out of the fact that you have to have one particular view or some view in this world, that's where these eel wrigglers sort of try to get out with some very smart speech. But the point to be made here is that Everybody has to have a view, a dogma, a sort of way of looking at life. Having a view is part of being a human being, part of having a mind. So there are such things as views. Just to say that all views just need to be abandoned, then that becomes impossible unless you sort of just die, have no mind at all, enter enlightenment and just cease without remainder. Having a mind means having a view. And I mention that because sometimes that people make no distinction there. But here the distinction was like obstinately holding to that view and sort of putting that view up there saying, this is right, all else is wrong. I said, that's the point here, just don't be so obstinate with your view saying, all this is right, all other things are wrong. That's what leads to clashes. So it's not the view which is wrong, it's the obstinacy in holding to it. And just using that as a means to argue with others and cause vexation. It's one of the reasons why the people who understand this position have led to the fact that Buddhism has always been a religion which has been tolerant, which hasn't gone around trying to convert others, which has been a very pacific religion. Because it hasn't sort of obstinately said, this is the view, everything else is wrong, and try to convert everybody else. But nevertheless, I'm sure that you all know the first fact of the Eightfold Path is right view. So it is this right view, there's a wrong view as well, and even the Buddha said there's such a thing as a wrong view. So what's going on there? The Buddha says over here, all these views, if you have a view, it just leads us to clashes and quarrels and vexation. Is the Buddha being a hypocrite there? Because he pronounced right view and wrong view. So what's the answer there? The answer is obviously that, sort of, number one, you don't obstinately adhere to the view and go around declaring, only this is true, everything else is wrong. Like a Buddhist doesn't go, no. Right view, the Eightfold Path, all this is right, everything else is wrong in every church and mosque in the world. So it's the obstinacy and the very fact that you keep on declaring those views. That's one of the things which is mentioned here. But also, even that which the Buddha said, right view, samaditi. Can you say that that is right and everything else is wrong? The point is, it's not a right or a wrong thing. It's the right view in Buddhism. It's not the fact that it's right and perfect. It's useful. It is the path. It's right in the context that it leads to nibbana. That it leads to cessation. It leads to peace. It leads to freedom. It's right in that sense, in that context. So when you say all this is right and everything else is wrong, instead of actually having it as some sort of ultimate view, ultimate principle which you have to argue with all others who disagree with you, the reason we have such a thing as right view or samma-ditti is not that it's perfectly right and everything else is wrong, it's but that is the view which leads to enlightenment. It also is a very accurate way of looking at life. But again, all views, they cannot be comprehensive. You cannot have a view which includes every possibility. Just by its very nature, you don't have enough time, not enough lifetimes, to gather every possible piece of data and have a view which is totally comprehensive. But nevertheless, that particular view is good enough. We would even call it perfect view. You might even call it useful view. Good enough to take you out of samsara. It's a view which is perfect in regard to its goal. Does that point come across? Yes, Dania. Okay, yes. In that sense that I didn't actually mention also with the Sammāditti, the views which lead to enlightenment, as we'll see in a few moments here, those are the views which don't create quarrels, which don't create disputations. It's almost like a sign of the view which leads to Nibbana is the view which does not include disputing. And one of the reasons for that, later on we'll see, is it's a view which doesn't enhance or support a sense of me and my view. So it undermines one of the great sources of contention. It's my view, and your view is something different. But that's coming in a few minutes. But these types of views, there are those types of views which do lead to contention, do lead to disputes. And you know, we all know what those are. Does a God exist? Does a God not exist? So those views which do lead to disputes, these are, knowing that they're not going to be conducive to peace, there's no way we're going to be able to prove those views by arguing with other people. Those types of views, because they're not going to lead anywhere, therefore we abandon them. Because they're not useful for the goal of living a peaceful, free life. Again, I would interpret this as because of the goal of this holy life. So therefore, seeing that they're not going to be useful, therefore we abandon them. So sometimes that people keep asking you as a monk, as a Buddhist, where did the universe come from? You know, okay, you can say that this is not the first universe, there's been multiple universes, but where did the first one come from? What's the origin of things? And you can have all sorts of ideas about that. But those are the sorts of views which will only lead to disputes and arguments. Some people see it different than you. And you can have sort of other sort of worldly arguments, and you just gave me which is the best footy team in Perth, which is the best female form or the male form. You know, who's the best driver, girls and boys or boys? You know, which is the most perfect? I mean, there's those sort of arguments. You know, does God exist? Does not God not exist? They can just lead to too many disputes. And there's other sort of arguments, like the Sammāditti, which totally undercut the idea of disputing. So, yeah, you want to come back? You're not disputing with me?
No.
Yes. Indeed. It's almost saying that, yes, that the Buddha is recommending that if a view is something which is going to be likely and conducive to arguments and vexation, then it can't be a right view. If it's a view which undermines those arguments, then maybe that can be a right view. Is that going to lead to arguments? Vexation. So if it's a right view, somehow or other, just to keep precepts by itself, that might lead to arguments, because that's part of a bigger right view. If it's a view to let go, if it's a view to not see your body or your conduct as coming from Chris, because it's not me, it's not mine, it's not a self, then that type of view is very conducive to having no arguments. But if it's some of those views, they say, I'm going to keep precepts, I'm going to keep 10 commandments, I'm going to keep so the Bodhisattva vows, and that's going to lead to arguments. Yeah, but remember, with arguments, you're saying there's many narcissistic people who can argue with you when you're doing sort of, you know, so-called right view things. But remember, they can argue with you, but do you argue with them? And this is one of the other sayings of the Buddha. He said, the world argues with me, but I don't argue with the world. So yeah, I mean, you can be doing something beautiful and right according to this right view business, which is not conducive to argument. So it doesn't make you argue, but people will always be arguing with you, no matter what you do in this world. People will always be disputing and arguing with you. So the point is, it's not the sense that you can totally evade arguments and disputes in this world. That becomes impossible, but you do not argue with the world. You do not dispute with the world. So we're trying to find a right view. It's not that people dispute with us, but you don't dispute with the world. Yeah? Yeah, yes, very good. Conducive to liberation view, conducive to peace, to freedom. Not conducive to, to more arguments coming from your side. Yep, we can do that. Okay, so let's actually see, having sort of mentioned that particular type of view, nothing is pleasing, some things are pleasing, and some things are pleasing, and some things are not pleasing. Oh, sorry, the three views here. Everything is pleasing, and nothing is pleasing, and some things are, some things aren't pleasing to me, and the Buddha was rejecting each one of those as being conducive to quarrels, disputes, clashes, vexation. Let's see what the Buddha puts forward as an alternative to that. Now here we go on paragraph 9. Now, Agiwesana, this is Diganaka's clan name, this body made of material form consisting of the four great elements procreated by a mother and father and built up out of fish and chips or rice and porridge in the case of this particular case or noodles or whatever you eat is subject to impermanence, to being worn and rubbed away, to dissolution and disintegration. It should be regarded as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumour, as a dart, as a calamity, as an infliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as void, as not self. When one regards the body thus, one abandons desire for the body, affection for the body, and subservience to the body. Now, this is a standard group of words to be regarded as impermanent, that's anicca. Remember, anicca, impermanent, that's the most common translation of that word. It also means like unreliable, uncertain, not constant. And I think you all know that sometimes your body's doing very well, thank you. But just when you need it the most, it's not going to perform for you. And as suffering, anybody who's over 50 or 60 should know that. As a disease, it is a sense of a disease because it's just wearing you away. And its nature is to be sick. As a tumour, as a dart means piercing and causing you pain. As a calamity, remember that wonderful story of that person who is recorded in a maternity ward in the United States, one of those three people which I know who spoke when they first came out of the womb, and this little baby emerged from his mother's womb and in front of the midwife and the doctor in a maternity ward in the United States spoke as soon as he came out of the womb. It was a boy, apparently. And said the classic words, "Oh no, not again." That's a great word to say. As soon as you're born, the first thing you say, look around, "Oh no, not again." So he regarded his rebirth as a calamity. As an affliction, as alien. It's nothing to do with me, this body. As an alien, not as if it's from Mars, this body, but as if it doesn't belong to you, not mine. As disintegrating, and you all know that, as void of an essence, as not self. It's amazing just how many people still identify with their body. And so much so that they can't let this body go. When it's about time to die, they'll do anything and almost everything to keep this body going. And having been with people who are dying, it's sometimes amazing. So why can't you just let it go, for goodness sake? It's falling apart. Why keep it together? Why can't we just let this body just go? So sometimes it's the time of death, or the time when you're challenged, when there's some sort of car accident, and you... I know, I've been in car accidents before, and those times when just you know you're going to hit the car in front of you, and just nothing you can do about it. And you can just see it coming, and time goes slow. It does actually go slow. I remember that perception for me a couple of times. Nothing you can do about it. I could just, okay, time to go, bye-bye. But a lot of people just can't do that. They go screaming. When people fall off a cliff, that's when you find out whether, you know, you've got your act together. You just sit there, okay, fine. Instead of screaming, So this is where we sort of, you know, we get attached to our body. And of course, there's all sorts of problems. And when you regard it as that, then you abandon desire for this body. You know, you look after this body, but you know, you don't regard it as something important for you. And affection for this body, that's a wonderful word, being affectionate towards it. Oh, you nice body, come on, you look after me and I'll look after you. Because it won't let you down all the time. And lastly, subservience to this body. Now, I have noticed in my own body just how much I have to serve my body. I'm often its slave. You know, it tells me to go to the toilet, and I have to go to the toilet. If I just decide, no, I'm not going to go to the toilet, it keeps reminding me and reminding me and reminding me. This is this person who never lets up. Take me to the toilet. I've got to go to the toilet. Take me to the toilet. I've got to go to the toilet. Take me to the toilet. And it never lets me go. And it's also sometimes when you've got a pain, you just got to try and do something about it. The body won't let you do anything else. So quite often, you know, you look at yourself, you are a slave to this body. And this body sort of rules the roost, as it were, and won't let you, you know, you're hungry. That's one of the nice things about being a monk, because sometimes we just don't follow those demands of the body. Sometimes we can't. I remember going to these talks with Ajahn Chah, and he'd carry on talking for 4, 5, 6 hours, and you couldn't go to the toilet. So, you know, you actually got a lot of discipline there, just sort of, you know, with your body. Just, there's no way you could go anywhere. So because of that, it was great training. And now as a monk, even on a Friday night, you know, I'm out there talking to people before the Friday night talk, and I just can't get to the toilet. And I come in here, and I'm sitting down here, and I can't get to the toilet. There's a whole line of people, they won't let me get to the toilet. Now, to be a teaching monk these days, it's not just having good meditation and being learned, being wise. You also have to have control of your bladder. That's one of the most important parts of being a teacher in today's world. So you can sit here, you don't have to get up. There's all sorts of stuff you have to look after your body. So you can see what you mean by being subservient to the body. And even like those times, we were talking the other day at monastery about that practice we used to have in Thailand of one night a week, we wouldn't go to bed, we'd stay up all night. And we're just discussing and that. And is that really useful for your meditation, just going without sleep? And Paddy, I said, no, it's not useful for meditation, just get into bad habits when you're meditating. And saying, much better if you're meditating, get into deep meditations, then carry on all night, fine. But don't just do it for the sake of doing it, because you just build up endurance. But somebody reminded me, but at least, the very least, it makes you like strong enough. You don't always have to go to sleep when you're tired. You realize if you go without sleep, you don't die. And you know, it does give you a sense of mental toughness there, that you know, if you're really sleepy, well, it doesn't matter. If you want to go to bed, fine, but you don't have to go to bed. You're not a slave to the tiredness of your body. Obviously, you can't do that too often, otherwise you'll get very sick, but at least it shows you that, you know, you're not afraid of going without sleep. It's not the end of the world. So, you abandon subservience to the body when you realize this body is just made of four elements, procreated by mother, father, built up of fish and chips, subject to impermanence, being worn and rubbed away, the dissolution, disintegration. So he said, this is one view. Now, is that view going to be leading to arguments? When you realize it doesn't belong to you, it's not my business. Somebody says it is, somebody says it isn't. Well, it's nothing to do with me. That's a sort of view which doesn't lead to arguments, because you haven't got a vested interest in your body when it's not yours. You haven't got a vested interest in proving it's true. going further than just that's his body. What about the mind? And where the Buddha is talking about the mind in this particular sutta, he's talking about that particular aspect of the mind, of the three types of feelings. Now, when you mention the word feeling, it doesn't mean the same as the English word feeling, which is either just the physical feeling of heat and cold or whatever, or the emotional feelings. This is a special word in Pali which does not have an equivalent in English. They just use the word feeling here for want of a better word. It is that quality of every sensory experience which is pleasant, unpleasant, or in between. So it's an aspect which is always there with every conscious experience. This moment has a pleasurable feature to it, an unpleasant feature to it, or something in between. And with every different sense, we have a different word for this thing we call here feeling. In other words, when you're seeing something, we have beauty and ugliness. Beauty is that pleasurable aspect of seeing. Ugliness is the unpleasant aspect of seeing. And, you know, like tasting, you know, it's like sweet, delicious. You know, it's like yucky. So say delicious is the pleasant aspect, the pleasant part of taste, and sort of, you know, yucky or bitter or whatever it is you don't like, that is the unpleasant part. We have pleasure and pain, is especially for the physical sense of touch. So in every one of these five senses, we do have a different word for this pleasurable feeling and unpleasant feeling. So, but here we just call it pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling. But that applies to every one of the six senses. So there are, Agyaweshana, three kinds of feelings: pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling. On the occasion when one feels pleasant feeling, one does not feel painful or neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When one feels only pleasant feeling, one doesn't feel the other two. When one feels neither painful nor pleasant feeling, again, one doesn't feel the other two. One only feels one at a time. Now, the Buddha actually says, pleasant feeling, Agyaweshana, is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, vanishing, fading away and ceasing. So this is just, it is impermanent. Number two, it is dependently arisen. It comes according to its causes. And it's subject to destruction, vanishing, fading away and ceasing. Painful feeling too is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, vanishing, fading away and ceasing. Neither painful nor pleasant feeling too is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, vanishing, fading away and ceasing. So first of all, every one of those feelings, the pleasant, unpleasant or in between, it is conditioned, dependently arisen, which means it's not conditioned by you. If it were conditioned just by you, you would have control over painful, unpleasant feeling. There are many other conditions which make pleasant feeling or unpleasant feeling or in between, and most of those you have no control over whatsoever. Which is why that when those conditions change and you can't do anything about it, so do the feelings change. And so no matter what those feelings are, they are totally beyond your control. That's why they come and go, according to their nature, not according to your will. Yes? Neither pleasant nor unpleasant feeling. Oh, just, now look at the carpet. Looking at the carpet, is that a pleasant sight or unpleasant sight? I can't say it's a ugly carpet, but it's not like some sort of work of art. So there's much of sight, it's like that sound. Like, you know, the sound of, you know, the wind, is that pleasant or unpleasant? It's a little bit pleasant, but it's not like, you know, listening to sort of Beethoven's Fifth or something. So it's a pleasant, this is a sort of pleasant, but it's not really, it doesn't really grab you and say, wow, isn't that a beautiful sound of the wind today? And you find that most of the feelings are neither pleasant nor unpleasant. That's why we only sort of notice those ones which are extremes, extremely unpleasant, extremely pleasant. They usually take our attention. Just when you go home this evening, just open up your refrigerator. And there's nothing to eat in it. That's an example of neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It doesn't grab you. If there was something in there that you really liked, that cake which I saved, for example, after the Dhamma talk, that's there now. That's a pleasant. But even that cake is dependently arisen, subject to destruction, it vanishes, fades away, and ceases after you've eaten it or when the dog eats it. And the thing is, it's beyond your control. So the reason the Buddha put this in here about the feeling, this is the only thing which he says about the mind, just that particular feelings. Because that's good enough, just to see the nature of the mind. It has huge consequences. One of the great consequences is, look, what's the point of going to a heaven world? Can a heaven world exist? You know, what is the idea of a heaven world, you know, in sort of religion? It's a place where you're happy ever after. In other words, continuous pleasant feeling forever and ever and ever. And you know, you look at this Buddhism business, and it can't be happiness forever and ever and ever and ever. It's impermanent, conditioned, dependent, arisen, subject to destruction, vanishing, fading away and ceasing. So when people ask you, what is the Buddhist view on heaven? We say, there's a heaven, but it is conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, vanishing, fading away and ceasing. And that is true. So that takes away a lot of the gloss, from going to heaven. And like a hell. Yeah, painful feeling. It's impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, vanishing, fading away and ceasing. Phew. Remember that if you ever go to hell. This is sort of, yes. And I put the framework of, these are mental pleasures, the pleasures of the sixth sense. And the thing with these pleasures, they are pleasures, they are impermanent, subject to cessation, they're conditioned. That's the sutta which I read 2 weeks ago, for those of you who remembered it, the Mahamalunkyaputta Sutta, where the Buddha said, just go for those pleasures of jhanas, but when you get to that pleasure of a first jhana, to know this is impermanent, conditioned, subject to cessation. So you turn your mind to something higher than that, the unconditioned, the peace, where everything ceases, the end of the six senses. So he said, still go for those jhanas, because that's an important stepping stone, that's a path. But it's not the end. As I think I did mention 2 weeks ago, it can be very easy for a person to get into those jhanas, and if they haven't sort of come to sutta class or something similar or better, means that they're going to take that jhana as the ultimate reality. This is it. This is the ultimate happiness. This is the permanent. This is heaven. This is bliss. This is oneness. And thereby they lose the fact that those things, they do disappear. They're conditioned. So that's one of the highest happinesses you can possibly have, but nevertheless, it's not the end. Yes. It's conditioned. If it's conditioned, it's dependent upon something. So the only thing which nibbana can be a ceasing of all the conditions. So there's no condition supporting it. If all the conditions have ceased, it's based on cessation. It's built on cessation. Standing on cessation. Everything stops. And the best simile is in the Agivatagota Sutta, which I've told you many times. The simile of the flame. A flame is, this is a beautiful simile. A flame is conditioned, it's dependent. What's it dependent upon? Say a candle flame is dependent upon the wax, the wick and the heat. You've got a wax there, you've got the wick there. You've got to light it first before you have a flame. But those are the three conditions. The heat, the wick and the wax. And when any one of those is taken away, the wax is all used up. The wick is burnt out. Or a wind blows the heat away. Then the flame goes out. And that was a beautiful simile, because the word for a flame going out is it nibbanas. That's where they get the word nibbana from. It was a word in common usage. So every villager would understand that word. Every kid would understand that word. It's flame, what happens when it goes out. So a flame, his whole existence was just the coming together of three conditions. And it didn't exist apart from those conditions. Therefore that's why I call conditioned. When it's gone, nothing left. Finished. So that is no more conditions. No more result. No more flame. And as they said, the Buddha said, to Agivatagota, where does that flame go? He said, east, west, north, south, up or down? Or does it go to the heaven where all flames hang out after they've lived their life in this world? So they live happily ever after, flickering without ever going out again. Is that what happens to all the flames? That's nonsense. Just the flame ceases, that's all. He said, that's just like you, Vachagota. You are just conditioned. You just come together because of these things. When one of those things disappears, especially craving, when that stops, you just poof, you go out like a flame. You don't go anywhere. You weren't anywhere to begin with. You were just a flame flickering. And whew, you're out, you've nibbana'd. What last bit of knowing? Yeah. People. Oh, yeah. Original mind or ground of all being or sort of wherever which people hold. I always say that we look for some little corner where we can put, some little hook we can put ourselves on. Again, I just go back to one of the, I think it's a Mahavedala Sutta, where the Buddha said there are two causes for right view, actually for seeing the Dhamma. This is the right view of the stream, the start of enlightenment. And those two causes are the yonisamanasikara, which is going to the source of things. That's a euphemism, as far as I'm concerned, of getting a jhana. Of going right so deep inside this body and mind. So getting the jhana is the first cause, but there's another cause as well. And the two of them have to be there. You can't have one without the other. So jhana is essential, but it's not enough. You need the other bit. And the other bit is actually called paratagosa, words of another, and it's just this is an abbreviation for the teachings from other Aryans, teachings of other enlightened beings. And when people say, well, what happens if you haven't got a great teacher there? Why is it some teachers say this and some teachers say that? And they say, even in the commentary, well, look at what the Buddha said. And that's one of the reasons why we started this sutta class years and years and years ago. So at least you can actually see the words of what was an obvious enlightened being, the Buddha. So what did the Buddha say about sort of, you know, nibbana? What did the Buddha say about sort of the end of things, about the mind and its subject to cessation? So by teaching you like this, that when you took out a jhana, you won't fall into that trap of thinking, yes, there can be a self somewhere in here. You will never think that these jhanas, or very deep jhanas, that is the end, that's the real me, that's the original mind, that's the ground of all being. But very often, Cheng, in some traditions, they actually ignore the teachings of the Buddha. They don't read suttas. Yeah. But very often people don't actually read the suttas, and because they don't read those suttas, and this is one thing that. Reading out suttas like this is actually, you don't find this in many forest traditions. But anyway, we should actually finish. I'm going to cut you off now because I've got to carry on. So we can talk about it afterwards. But it is one of the points then. It's a good point. But here we're just going to the three feelings over here. And to notice that only one comes at a time, and that these are all... depending on the origin, subject to destruction, vanishing, fading away and ceasing, they're out of control. And that's one of the most important things here. To know that these are dependently origin, subject to dependently origin, conditioned, impermanent, and that you can't control them. Now when actually you get really into that idea, that you can't control these things. It's pleasant, painful, in between. Beautiful, you hear lovely things, you hear things you don't like to hear. How can you control these things? Understanding that gives you a huge change of attitude, so you don't go seeking for a heaven world. That goal of most religions, to try and do whatever it takes to be born in the heaven and live happily ever after. And I'm not talking about just a simple sort of Christian heaven. Even like a heaven of like the ground of all being, or sort of some sort of original mind state where you can live happily ever after. The whole idea of living happily ever after anywhere is totally undermined when you understand that teaching. There is no happy ever after. Cannot be, essentially. There is no happy ever after. There is no happy ever after. There is no happy ever after. There cannot be. Essentially. Impossible. You see why. So what does that mean? All that striving for happy ever after is just put aside. Abandoned. Given up. All craving. The source of the ultimate craving. Is abandoned. Number 12. Seeing thus, a well-taught noble disciple becomes disenchanted with pleasant feeling, disenchanted with painful feeling, disenchanted with neither painful nor pleasant feeling. It's seen through the con of this. It's just like a used car salesman. This car is a beautiful car. It's only been kept in a garage by an old woman who's never gone out except to go to the shops. It's been perfectly looked after. It's a wonderful... That sort of con job of saying that you can have pleasure forever after. You can actually get rid of painful feeling if you're smart enough. You see through that scam. You become disenchanted with that. Disenchanted with a pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant feeling. I like the word enchanted. That's a very good translation because, being enchanted is some sort of magic trick which some sort of witch puts on you. And, it deceives you. You're being conned into thinking this is a beautiful thing, and then somehow or other, you meet somebody and they sort of release you from that enchantment, and now you see the truth of things and think, wow, what's going on? There's another beautiful simile, and that's in one of the other suttas there, and it's this thing in the Sanghita Nikaya. It's a simile of the blind man who's been sold the cloth. It's one of my favorite similes, and the Buddha actually said, it's just like a man who was born blind. And, he's having a nice time, he's healthy otherwise, and this salesman comes to the village and selling them the most beautiful cloth. In the time of the Buddha, it was called Benares cloth, from Varanasi, the most wonderful, beautiful cloth. And so he goes around selling this beautiful cloth, and this blind man says, well, even I'm blind, I like nice things as well. So he says, okay, I want some of this nice cloth to make some clothes for myself. And so this salesperson, realizing this guy can't see, sells him an oily rag. And of course the guy can't tell it's just an oily rag. He thinks it's a beautiful Benares cloth. And so he pays a lot of money for it, and he goes around wearing this oily old rag, thinking it's something really expensive. And a few days later, as it happens, a doctor comes by and said, I can heal your blindness, and gives him some medicine, and it works, and he can see again. And then he notices, what the hell, I'm wearing this oily rag, it's supposed to be a Benares cloth. What is that stupid salesman? And he gets angry, quite obviously so. And, that's what the Buddha said, that when you see the Dhamma, it's like your eyes are healed by the doctor. They say, my God, I've been sold a dud. This mind of mine is just like a dirty, oily cloth, and I thought it was something beautiful. This body I thought was going to be a source of great pleasure and happiness for me. I've been sold a dud. And this is actually what happened. You see these feelings, which you thought were wonderful, and searching for beautiful happiness in this world, having a great time in this world, and having beautiful food, and going around and seeing wonderful sights, seeing the sunset over Uluru, going up the Ganges, seeing these wonderful sights in the world, having great sex, just hearing just the Beethoven's Fifth by the German Symphony Orchestra or whatever, Berlin Symphony Orchestra, having these wonderful experiences in life, until you hear the Dhamma, I've been sold a dud. That's what I mean by being disenchanted. And being disenchanted, you become dispassionate. No, it's just Beethoven's Fifth again. Oh, just another sunset. Oh, just another sort of beautiful meal. Oh, just another. You become dispassionate. These things don't grab you anymore, they're not so important. Pleasure, pain, and in between don't have the same sense of urgency as they did before. Disenchanted, dispassionate. And through dispassion towards these things, it's just painful feeling, that's all, just pleasant feeling, the craving goes. Also the anger goes. And through dispassion, the mind becomes liberated. Free. Free from what? Free from craving. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It's liberated. You understand. Because being liberated from craving, there's going to be no cause for any rebirth. The craving which creates a rebirth is gone. You understand? Birth is destroyed. The whole life has been lived, done the job. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. No more reincarnation, no more rebirth. A monk, nun, I'd even say lay person whose mind is liberated thus, Agyavesana, sides with none and disputes with none. They employ the speech commonly used in the world without adhering to it. So you're not disputing and trying to disprove anybody. You say your peace, just like the Buddha was just. Has the Buddha disputed with this monk, with this wanderer? He just said what he said and left it at that. So they may argue with him, but he won't argue with them. You just see, just pain, pleasure, that's all there is. Just body, just mind. But they employ the speech currently used in this world without adhering to it. So the person still, Buddha still says what he needs to say. But this is not arguing. You know it's arguing when he said, no, that can't be right. This is right. You got it wrong. I'm the one who's got it right. Now, I also mention, one more time, they employ the speech currently used in the world. So when we speak Buddhism, we don't speak it in Pali. You know why? Because that's not currently used in this world. We don't use archaic language. That is not currently used in the world. So that's why when I insist on saying such as no need to seek for vengeance, Khan will get the bastards anyway for the next calendar, I'm just using speech currently used in the world. These are monks, shouldn't say bastard, they shouldn't say shit word. But look, see, it says currently used in the world. What you use, I have to use, okay? So just because you're a monk, it doesn't mean you have to use special monk language. The things which you can say at home to each other, but I'm not allowed to say. No, you have to do it as you say. And that's one of the other places. Speech is currently used in this world. Yeah. I'm not going to dispute with you. Okay, I'm not going to dispute with you. Go on, Dalia. It's an assembly, things coming together, and sometimes when they come together they do have another name. You split them apart and they're not exactly the same when they're apart as when they're together. And the chariot is one of those similes. You disassemble a chariot, there's a wheel, there is a cart, there's vanes, I don't know much about chariots. But you know, separate, they're not a chariot. Put them together, they are a chariot. Wax, heat, and wick, they come together, that's flame. It disassembles, especially the idea of a sense of self, of me and mine. Disassemble the body, disassemble the mind. And you see, there's no one here, nothing there. Now, paragraph 13. A monk, nun, meditator whose mind is liberated does... Oh, I said that already. Number 14. Now, on that occasion... Very beautiful. But it's vanished already. You see, just pleasant sound is impermanent. And you had no control over that, even though we asked people to turn off their mobile phones. It just, sometimes they just turn on by themselves. You don't have to feel guilty about that. It just happens. That's just part of nature. So now, on that occasion, a venerable Sariputta was standing behind the Blessed One, fanning him. Then he thought, the Blessed One indeed speaks of the abandoning of these things through direct knowledge. Especially just been talking about the three feelings and the body. The Sublime One indeed speaks of the relinquishing of these things through direct knowledge. As the Venerable Sariputta considered this, through not clinging, the three feelings and the body, his mind was totally liberated from the outflowings. This is the word called tensia. You can imagine that when there's no sort of craving left for pleasure, pain, or in between, it's just life, you just leave it alone. It means you'll never go out there into the world trying to seek for pleasure, trying to make sure that unpleasant things disappear as soon as possible. Seeing that there's nothing to do with him, it's just not mind is subject to destruction, that he can actually let these things go. So by being liberated from the taints, that means the outflowings, he became fully enlightened. He was already a stream winner a long time ago, and he had been practicing the jhanas, as he says later on. So this was again one of those straws which broke the camel's back. The last piece of teaching, just to make the final state into being a full arahat. But in the wonder of Dīpanākara, the one who actually asked the question, he said the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose. In other words, the right view. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. The wanderer Dīpanākara saw the Dhamma, attained the Dhamma, understood the Dhamma, fathomed the Dhamma, crossed beyond doubt, did away with perplexity, gained intrepidity, and became independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. He became what's called a stream winner. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. And he saw that, just the body is subject to arising, so it's subject to cessation. Feelings are subject to arising and subject to cessation, and with it your mind. The citta is subject to arising and subject to cessation. The citta stops. Feelings stop. Perceptions stop. It is seeing the possibility that just everything stops, subject to cessation, means that there can never be an independent, eternal entity there. As long as there's an eternal entity somewhere, a self, a soul, no matter what you think that actually is, then there's not cessation anymore. There's permanence. And all is subject to cessation. And that become the extreme winner. He fathomed the Dhamma, understood it, crossed beyond doubt, did away with perplexity, gained intrepidity, it's a very hard word to say, and became independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. He understood the truth. But now was a job he had to sort of make that truth become real. In another simile, they said that the Buddha, there was two monks, they were stream winners, and somebody was asking him, said, well, what's the difference when you got right view, you understand the Dhamma, how come you're not fully enlightened? And they gave the simile of the well, one of the best similes. It says, well, look, we know the well. We can see the water at the bottom of it. But we've got no bucket or rope, so we can't draw the water out. And he said, that's like a stream. When they can see the Dhamma, they understand it, but they can't actually make it theirs. They can't live that truth. See it, but can't live it yet. They haven't got the bucket to actually draw the water out and drink that water. So you know the Dhamma, you know things are impermanent, but now you've got to make that sort of, make it yours, as it were. That right view is there, but it takes a while for that right view to change just the way that you perceive and think about life. View changes first, and there is what I call the time lag. Once the right view is in place, the time lag for your perception to change. So you do actually perceive things all the time as me, as not me, not mine, myself. And you think that way. A good example of that is Ananda. Ananda, who was already a stream winner, but when the Buddha died, you know, he just lost it. He forgot. He said, all the Dhamma disappeared from me. I just couldn't see it. And so he's just so upset and sad the Buddha was dying and started crying. Yes. Yes, going back to the source is a good thing to go back to. Arias and jhana. Yeah. Well, yeah, no, that's actually a very good description of what jhana is. Because, you know, you've heard me teach such a long time, Jacob, but, you know, you always go in and in and in and in. So you go into this, you know, this body, you know, you go into the time, into this moment, you go into the silence, which is in the middle of the present moment. In the middle of the silence, there you find the breath, in the middle of the breath you find a beautiful breath, in the middle of the beautiful breath you find nimitta. You know, actually, that's almost like what you experience. Nimitta comes out from the very middle of things. And right in the middle of the nimitta you get the first jhana, in the middle of the first jhana you get the second jhana. Because what's happening, you're letting things go, you're letting things disappear. And those things are disappearing. You're going into what's, you know, your body and mind. Yeah. It gives you the data as well. Yonisi Manasikara is the data of, you know, what's actually inside of this? Who am I? You just go deep inside to see just, you know, what's the control. It's just in the same way that sometimes there's a kid and have a radio. And, you know, just what is it? You take it apart trying to see what's in the center of this thing. You know, what's this sort of thing which creates all of this? So in particular, you're finding your consciousness, your mind, now with its will. And that's really in the center of things. Now figuratively and also almost literally. Now in this body and mind, said the Buddha, you'll find the beginning and end of this world. So you go right inside. And achieving that enough penetration, going deep enough, first jhana is deep enough. Deeper jhanas, obviously, you get more data, but that's the minimum requirement of yonisamanasikara. Go deep enough in, at least you get into a jhana beyond the body. Hear the word of the Buddha and understand it. You can be a stream winner. You can be a one on the path to being a stream winner. And again, one of the problems here that it mentioned this before several times, it does seem to be that sometimes people become stream winners, they see the Dhamma without any jhanas whatsoever. And to me, that just makes a lot of conflict there. It seems impossible that there is an example of that happening. So, how can we make a resolution there? Or bring those two ideas, the experiential of how on earth can you understand seeing oneself without getting into a jhana. And the only possible way of resolving that conflict is understanding that even in the suttas, it's a very loose between calling a person being on the path to being a stream winner and actually achieving that stream winning status. And the reason why that there is a looseness of saying, yes, they were on the path, or yes, they attained stream winning, is because, you know, one leads inextricably to the other. Once you are a stream winner on the path, you have to attain in this lifetime. There's no alternative. And the simile which I've used before, you've heard me say this before, using it from current language, you know, if you've upset, say, one of the bikie gangs, You haven't paid your dues. And one of them comes up to you and says, Jacob Medin, you're dead. Now, you're not dead yet. You're still alive. He's made a mistake. But what he's actually meaning is your death is so certain. There's no way you're going to escape that. So, Jacob Medin, you're dead. In the same way that you've seen enough Dhamma to say, Jacob Medin, you're a stream winner. I'm not a stream winner, but, you know, it's inevitable. You're on the path. So that's why they say, like the bikie, Jacob Medin, you're a stream winner. Now that's what I mean, and I think that's what they say in the suttas. Yeah. Well, yeah, it is. Yeah, one standing, actually. He was standing at the time. So again, there we go. Diganaka, he was a wanderer. Did he do jhanas? Very unlikely. But there the one was a stream winner. But was he really a stream winner or just on the path of being a stream winner? Very hard to know, actually. But sometimes the Buddha was such a powerful teacher, much more powerful than any monk alive today, or any nun alive today. So maybe that was just a special case with the Buddha. But that being aside, it's a good, great sutta there, because there, by talking about the body just being just conditioned, being subject to cessation, you can't control it, and the feelings being subject to cessation. Now that is a view, but that is a view which should not lead to arguments, to disputation, to vexation, but stops all those arguments and vexations, because it leads eventually to letting go of things to non-self, to seeing there's nobody in here. And the biggest part of arguments is not so much the view, but the MY you put in front of view. My view. And views which undermine that sense of ownership and sense of self, they are the views which don't lead to arguments and disputes, quarrels and vexations. It is the obstinately holding on to it, which I pointed out at the beginning, was the biggest problem. Not so much the view itself, but that the view was conducive to obstinacy and holding on. Whereas the views which we call right view, which an example was given here, the body is not me, not mine, not a self, suffering, impermanent. Feelings are not me, not mine, not a self, suffering, impermanent. Those are views, you have to call them views, ways of looking at life, which undermine the I, which causes the obstinacy and the holding. So that is how I understand that sutta there. The Buddha was beginning with this argument, this very argumentative wanderer, who had a very good line, which was very difficult to defeat. Nothing is pleasing to me, but the Buddha sort of said something smart, but that didn't really work. So the Buddha just said, all these views that you have, and people argue with them, but if you come to this particular line of reasoning, yes, it is a view, but it's a view which undermines the sense of self, which causes the arguments to begin with. So that's where there's an end of quarrels. When there's no person being in there who's so attached to their view that they have to hold it on at all costs. In another sutta, very deep, it is, in one sense, your views which make you. Most views of the world are what construct the person you hold yourself to be. The views are very much the condition, the cause of that thing which you call a self. So views cause a self, self causes views. It goes round and round and round, arguing with other people and arguing with yourself. And the Buddha found this particular type of view which totally undermines everything. A view which undermines the sense of self, which means it doesn't create any more views. Yeah. It was very much so that why that particular sutta was what caused Sariputta to become fully enlightened. And it was because he'd been practicing a disciple of the Buddha for such a long time. And had been practicing, he would have done the jhanas. And in the Anupada Sutta, Sariputta describes his experience of jhanas. So he was a person who attained those jhanas. So here was that last, as I call it, the straw which broke the camel's back. The last piece of the jigsaw puzzle put together. The last little bit of inspiring teaching which was given just at the right time so Sariputta would become totally enlightened. I mentioned this, you're hearing exactly the same as what made Sariputta enlightened. But are you enlightened now? It's because Sariputta had all this other practice, all these other experiences before him. Had all this together, and then it's this final little insight which made him see the total truth. And I'm just trying to get some more examples. When I visited my mother a long time ago, I saw in the newspaper there was a BBC documentary, and it was on the discovery of the gene by those two Cambridge physicists. Who were they again? But anyway, one was a United States guy, and it was supposed to be a very highly recommended documentary. Because I was from Cambridge, I thought that'd be a nice thing to watch. And these two guys, what were their names again? The guys who invented the gene, Watson and Crick. Crick and Watson. And, maybe 10 years before us. But, you can still recognize much of, Cambridge over there. And just the whole search, for finding out just, the way the gene works. I'm not sure how accurate it was, but there was that part of the movie where Watson, he just cut out shapes, because this was just one way of looking at sort of the construction of this particular molecule, and he cut this other molecule out in another shape, and he was just turning it around and they fat, and that was his moment. And with just that moment of it was very well acted, the moment came, they cracked it, that one moment of insight. And then the next moment that Francis Crick was dancing down the street of King's Parade going to the pub, shouting everybody a drink, saying, "I've just found the secret of life, I've just found the secret of life," which he had. But, people in the bar never understood that, they just wanted the free beer. And that was actually true, he did actually dance down King's Parade in Cambridge. He just made a great discovery which got him Nobel Prize. But, it's just that moment there, just messing around, just something clicked, that moment of insight, that last, and they've been working on this for I don't know how long. Now those moments when just things click, just that light bulb goes on. And that's what happens here with Sariputta. He's been with the Buddha, listening to this Dharma, that Dharma, getting jhanas. And that's what we see here. That last moment. So that's why it's very beautiful and inspiring. But Sariputta did not dance down the road and buy people a beer. Because the pub was too far away. From the vulture's peak. But that's actually the last moment of enlightenment. So even though the last moment is there, if anybody else had just been playing around with those shapes, it would have meant nothing to them. It's everything which went beforehand as well as included in that last moment of enlightenment. This is the culmination, the last little piece. Okay. So having become a stream winner, then the usual ending, Digganaka said to the Blessed One, Magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. You know, the usual similes for someone who can actually see Dhamma now. I go to the Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dharma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today let Master Gotama remember me as the lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. Point out here, just a small point, the three refuges. To the Buddha, the Dhamma, Sangha of what? Sangha of Bhikkhus. Something doesn't say that. And to the Sangha of Bhikkhus, to Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha of Bhikkhus. Sometimes it says Sangha of Bhikkhunis, especially when a Bhikkhuni made that remark. It's a monastic Sangha. So I'll let you think about that one. So, here we go. That's a Dīgha-nikāya sutta. And it's amazing, I did try and spin it out for 1.5 hours. Because it's only one page on your sheets over there, just 4 pages in this book. But a very nice sutta, all about views, enlightenment, sense of self, and the end of all disputations. Okay. Very good. So now we can pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and if you wish to discuss any more, most welcome.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvakkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅkhaṃ namāmi